Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Thank you so much for coming out tonight. I really appreciate it. I'm in the middle of a 40-city book tour, but I'm still in the first half of it, so I'm not like a babbling, drooling idiot yet. Maybe that'll happen toward the end. But I do remember the last time I was here at this very store. It was back in 2008, and I was reading from my novel, The Hour I First Believed. And lots of times stops on the book tour sort of blur away. But I have vivid memories of that night, and particularly the really warm and welcoming crowd. So I'm glad some of you are back, and others of you have shown up for the first time. Anyway, I'd like to tell you a little bit about my fifth novel, We Are Water, which came out on October 22nd. But before that, in preparation for this 40-city book tour, my clothes were getting a little shabby, so I went and did book tour shopping, something I try to avoid at all times. But so I go into the store, and I said to the woman, well, I'm here because I need cooler jeans, because I have like grandpa jeans, and I'm going off on book tour. And she said, well, can you be a little bit more specific about what kind of jeans you want? And I said, well, skinny jeans are really popular, right? And she said, yes. And I said, okay, so what I'm looking for is skinny jeans on the bottom and fat guy jeans up on the top. And so I must say that you moms out there in the audience have been holding back on me, because these maternity jeans I'm now wearing are very comfortable. Anyway, let me tell you a little bit about We Are Water, how it came about, and so forth. I would have to say that this is a story about racism. It is a story about a family tragedy and the evolution of American social mores in this, the 21st century. And also, it is a reflection on how and why visual artists do what they do, and whether or not the creative process is perhaps a form of madness. In some ways, this story is very different from its siblings. My earlier novels, She's Come Undone, and I Know This Much Is True, and The Hour I First Believed. For one thing, this one is told in eight different voices. Four of those voices are female, four of them are male. And I'm going to give you, in a few minutes, I'll give you a little sample of that. But although my approach was different this time, my goal was really pretty much the same as it was for my earlier stories. And that goal is to go in search of the un-me, the other, and to explore not only the ways in which we're all different from one another, but what binds us together and makes us one. The ways in which I'm you and you're me and we are all together, cuckoo, ca-choo. couple of Beatles fans out there. We Are Water is rooted in two events that I recall quite vividly from my childhood in my hometown of Norwich, Connecticut. Now, when I say Connecticut, it's liable to conjure stereotypical images of those sort of fancy bedroom towns that are close to New York on the western side of Connecticut. You know, kids go to prep school and people join the country club, and but that's not my Connecticut. I live in eastern Connecticut. We're more influenced by Boston than by New York. I would say we're probably more feisty than fashionable, or let's call us more liverwurst than pate. We in eastern Connecticut, We tend to root for the Red Sox, and we use the word wicked as an adverb before, you know, every sentence has the word wicked in it. Like, I'm wicked glad to be here tonight. Yeah. Anyway, and if I were to call you wicked pissa, that's a compliment, okay? Anyway, so in 1950s Norwich, Connecticut, there was an unschooled African-American artist. His name was Ellis Ruley, and he lived and painted and was married to a white woman, which was pretty unusual, even in New England back in that time. Sadly, in his own lifetime, Ellis Ruley could not sell any of his own paintings. And although the coroner ruled his death in 1959 to be accidental, Norwich's black community disputed that conclusion. He was found head first and feet up in a well on his property. Accident, right? And since his posthumous discovery back in the 1980s, when suddenly his paintings, which were thought to not exist anymore, began to appear in garage sales and the like, Ellis Ruley's works today are prized by museums and collectors of American folk art. He was an outsider artist, untrained. He didn't have the technical skills, but his work is very dramatic, and it suggests story. The colors are very lively. In my novel, Ellis Ruley is the template for a fictional character that I named Josephus Jones. He's a laborer who paints pictures because he can't not paint them. And there is a second Norwich thread to this novel, and that is a devastating flood that occurred in the city in March of 1963. Now, I was 12 that year. A dam holding back a lake suddenly collapsed, and it unleashed about 6 million gallons of water that rushed downhill and took a path of death and destruction. Most of the downtown shopping area was destroyed, and 5 people lost their lives. And I still remember that night very vividly. The flood happened about 6 or 7 houses down from where we lived, and I can still in my ears hear the roar of the water and also the screams of third shift factory workers who sadly were buried alive in the building where they were working when it collapsed. The raging water cut a path about 6 or 7 down houses down from where we lived, as I mentioned. And I remember the ice that had been frozen on top of the pond was shooting down. You know, I'm talking about blocks of ice the size of refrigerators and, trees and cars and stuff just shooting by. Of all the stories that I heard subsequently about the flood that night, the one that affected me most and still affects me the most is the story of the Moody family. Now, Ron Moody and his wife, whose nickname was Honey, were young parents. They were in their mid-20s, and they had 3 little boys. Tom was 4 years old the night of the flood. His brother Jimmy was 2. And Sean was a baby. He was an infant. They received about 5 minutes warning that the flood was coming, and they were told by somebody who screamed into the window at their house that they should get out. And so they made the fateful decision to get in their car and try to outrun the water. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. The wall of water hit them from the back in their car. Also in their car was a 19-year-old upstairs neighbor, a kid named Tony, who was helping them. Anyway, the car lifts off the road, goes into a tailspin, and falls off of a 15-foot retaining wall. The family in the car and their neighbor, Tony, they go underwater. They somehow manage to get out of the car. And Mr. Moody and Tony climb up into a tree, and they're handing the three little boys up. Mrs. Moody was handing them up so that they would be safe. But sadly, the water took her away, and she was drowned that night. And so, the kids grew up without a mother. Oddly enough, Mrs. Moody's mother, the kid's grandmother, tells a story that the week before the flood happened, her daughter turned to her and got a strange look on her face and said, "Ma, if something ever happened to me, would you raise the kids?" And, of course, something did happen, and the grandmother did step up, and she raised those three little boys with the help of their father. Anyway, in constructing the novel, I used the Moody family story and the Ellis Ruley story as two distinct and different poles, almost like electrodes. And between those two electrodes, the fiction started jumping and sort of, you know, the electricity happened. And so I took these two non-fictional events and began to fictionalize about them. Now, they were unrelated in actuality, but I connected them in this story. It's a story about an American family, the O family, and that last name is O-H. And the patriarch, Orion O, is half Chinese and half Italian. Now, try and picture that. I was about 2 years into the writing of it, and I kept looking on Google Images and so forth, trying to find somebody who would look half Italian and half Chinese. I never did find anybody. So those of you who are of a certain age might remember an actor from the 1970s and 80s, a guy named James Ferrantino. And so I just decided Orion would look like James Ferrantino. I made an executive decision. Now, he is a workaholic psychologist who works at a university in this story. And he's a bit asleep at the wheel as far as the raising of his and his wife's children. His wife is Annie. And like Josephus Jones and like his prototype, Ellis Ruley, Annie O is untrained, but she begins obsessively to make art. She doesn't know why. She makes angry art, and she does this by scavenging for things that people leave on the sidewalk or things in landfill and so forth, and she constructs these sort of strange and angry installations. Anyway, she becomes quite successful, and she is represented by a gallery owner in New York, and she moves to New York to be closer to the art scene, so she and Orion have a long-distance marriage, and in the process of that separation, she falls in love with the gallery owner, a woman named Vivica. And so when I said I'm examining the social mores of the 21st century, Annie and Vivica decide, she leaves Orion, and Annie and Vivica decide they're going to be married. Now, in Connecticut, I think it was about 2008 when gay marriage was legalized in the state where I live. So I'm examining not only Annie and Orion's reactions to this, but also the reactions of their three grown children as well. They have kids in their 20s. They have fraternal twins, their daughter Ariane and their son Andrew, and the twins' younger sister Marissa. And they have very different reactions from one another about their mother's decision. So I'm going to read in Orion's point of view, and then just a little bit, and then a little bit from Annie's point of view, and then you're going to hear from one of those three children. And after that, I would be happy to take some questions and comments if you have them, and then I'll also happy to sign and personalize your books and pose for pictures with you if you'd like to do that. So anyway, Orion O, here is his voice. You know, looking back, I'm amazed at how much in denial I was about her and Vivica. I mean, yeah, I'd get worried from time to time, but what I thought was that maybe she had gotten involved with some other guy. I'd imagine him, worry about him, even sometimes picture her walking hand in hand with him. some artist or musician type, some lanky New Yorker guy with a pork pie hat and a couple days' worth of stubble. But the only time I confronted her about another man, she got huffy, said that it was all about her work and that my insecurity was my problem, not hers. And hey, whenever I called her, she was almost always there where she was supposed to be, either at her studio or at night at Vivica's house. Once when I called and Vivica answered, she said, "Oh, you know, Oren, one of these days you and I will have to meet in person." I let it go that she had gotten my name wrong and that we had already met several years back at the biennial opening. "Yeah, I'd like that too," I said. I went down to visit Annie at the apartment two or three times, but every time I did, Vivica was out of town for the weekend. I still don't know when they made the switch from roommates to lovers. Annie has told me that it happened over time, that their affair was not premeditated. And I believe her. But it's interesting, you know, the way she put it, premeditated, as if it was a crime, which in a way it was. It was the murder of our marriage. You know, sometimes when we want something to be true so badly that we convince ourselves that it is true. How many times had I suggested that one to the undergraduates sitting across from me in my office? Some self-deluding young woman who was trying to convince herself that her boyfriend's having smacked her around once was not only a one-time thing. Or some younger guy's assertion that although sex with other guys excited him, he wasn't really gay. "Put your hand out," I would tell these students. "Now bring it closer. And now bring it closer still." And when their hands were half an inch from their noses, I would ask them to describe what they saw. "It's a blur," they'd say. And I'd suggest that sometimes the closer we got to a situation, the less clear it looked. And that when wishful thinking trumped the reality we might otherwise be able to see more clearly and manage, we were setting ourselves up for a rude awakening. Well, psychologist, heal thyself. Because little by little I began to withdraw my own hand from my face, as it were, began to face the fact that Annie and I no longer were together, that she had defected. So that's Orion and his take on the dissolution of their marriage. Here's Annie's. "The truth, whether Orion believes it or not, is that I hadn't left him for Vivica. I had left him for New York, for the opportunities that it offered me creatively and commercially. What developed between Vivica and me had been unplanned. My defection, Orion had called it on that awful Sunday back in Connecticut when I finally admitted that Vivica and I had become involved, that I had fallen in love with her. I was a Judas," he said. "I could get my own goddamned ride back to the train station because he sure as hell was not going to take me. He was through with being a fucking sap. And so I had had to hire a cab to New Haven, and on the train ride back to the city, I kept replaying our argument. Well, if I was Judas, that made him Jesus Christ, right? Well, maybe he should come down from his cross and take some responsibility for the fact that our marriage had failed. Which of us had practically raised Andrew and the girls single-handedly all those years when he would leave for work early and come home late, sit in his office all day and into the evening, counseling college kids about their problems? Well, what about my problems? What about the fact that I felt frustrated and neglected all those years while he was playing savior to all those troubled students of his, and then coming home and feeling sorry for himself because of the toll they took, drinking his beers and falling asleep by 9, when I still had laundry to fold and put away and 3 school lunches to make for the next morning before I could go down to my gloomy little studio and grab a measly hour or two for my work. But thank God, the bitterness has subsided on both of our parts. We have our kids to thank for that and our mutual investment in their lives. and our shared worries about their unhappiness and their safety, Ariane's failed romances, and our worries about where Andrew's military career might take him, where Marissa's impetuousness might take her. Our concern for our kids' well-being binds us despite the divorce, and it will always bind us. And Orion has come around. He's made an effort with Vivica, despite the fact that I can tell he can't stand her. Whether Vivica understands it or not, I still care about Orion, which is why I'm worried about him, and why maybe I shouldn't have put his name on the guest list, made the decision myself instead of listening to my daughter's, "Daddy is an adult, Mom. He can decide if he wants to go or not." Because the last thing I want to do is make him feel that he has to come if it'll be too weird or too painful to him. Now, what did I do with that water? Oh, here it is. I mentioned that the repercussions with their kids become interesting to me while I'm writing this story. Now, I'm not the kind of writer, I'm always envious of the kind of writer who can, you know, outline the whole story and write toward a preconceived ending. Doesn't work that way for me. I think I could write more efficiently if it did, but I have to keep showing up at the desk to find out what's going to happen next. And it's unpredictable. And so when the 3-0 kids began to talk, I hadn't planned that. But I learned a lot about their parents and their family life. Now, when the kids were growing up, and Orion is off, working at the university for all hours, Annie is in charge of the kids. And Annie, based on her childhood problems, she's quick to anger and quick to go out of control when she is angry. But the only one she targets is her male child. She writes angry art. She's angry often toward Andrew, who is a button pusher. He and his mother have a sort of an adversarial relationship, although there is also a deep love. Now, what happens is that the kids sort of shield their mother. Orion doesn't know that a lot of this stuff is going on domestically while he's away at work. Andrew grows up, and he enters the military. And although he's always been the wild child of the family, when he enters the military and goes to Fort Hood, he becomes involved with an evangelical Christian girl who becomes his fiance. Now, in this scene that I'm going to read last, you're going to hear Andrew, you're going to hear his fiance, and you're going to hear a third character who you may recognize if you listen to the radio much. Are you ready? "I tidied up my point of view. I got a new attitude. I'm Dr. Laura Schlesinger, and I do welcome you to this hour of the program. Our number here is 1-800-DR-LAURA. That's 1-800-DRLAURA. I'm here with Kimberly Neal, who screens your calls, Benjamin Pratt, who orchestrates our music, and me. I am my kid's mom, ready to preach, teach, and nag you into doing the right thing. Casey Lee, welcome to the program. Hi, Dr. Laura. Thank you for taking my call." "Thank you. I've been listening to you since my mom used to pick me up from grade school, and I just wanted to say what an honor it is to speak with you." "Thank you. How can I help?" "Well, the thing is, I'm sorry, I'm a little nervous." "It's okay. Do you want me to give you some background, or should I get right to my question?" "Well, why don't you just start, and we'll see where it goes." "Okay. Well, actually, I'm calling for my fiancé. He's got a family situation that he's struggling with, so I suggested we call Dr. Laura to see what she has to say about it." "And your fiancé's name is?"
"Andrew."
"His problem? Well, his parents are divorced, okay, and his mother is getting remarried."
"To a woman?"
"Uh-huh. And your question for me is?"
"Whether or not we should go to their wedding. You see, he grew up in a family that was not very religious, but
Since we've been going out, he has found his Lord and Savior. And we already said we wouldn't go, but now he's getting pressure from one of his sisters about how we should, because it'll hurt their mother if we don't. And yesterday, his mom's partner sent us plane tickets so that we can surprise her. And, well, the thing is, I mean, don't you think gay marriage is sinful?
Well, what I think is beside the point. What do you think?
I think it is.
Okay.
Now, a minute ago you said that this was your fiancé's problem, so why is it that you're calling me instead of him?
Well, because I said I would. But he's right here, though.
Ah, well, why don't you put him on?
Oh, okay.
She wants to talk to you.
No, I don't want him.
Well, yeah.
Okay. Hello?
Hi, Andrew.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Now, first of all, I have a note here from Kimberly that says you're a member of the military.
Yes, ma'am. United States Army, Specialist E-4.
Ah, and what is your specialty, soldier?
Well, I'm in a nurse's training program.
Well, thank you for your service to your country, and hoo-yah!
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, ma'am.
Casey Lynn says that you're conflicted about going to your mother's wedding, so why don't you tell me about that?
Okay, well, like Casey said, she's getting married to a woman, all right? My mother's an artist. She's kind of a free spirit, you know? And well, her and this woman have been living together for a while, and now they're going to get married, which, you know, they can do legally because the wedding's going to be in Connecticut. And so, well, part of me thinks I should go because, you know, she's my mom. And what's the other part telling you?
What?
Well, you just told me that part of you is telling you to go, so I'm assuming there's another part that's telling you not to, right?
Well, yes, ma'am.
Because?
Because I don't, well, you know, me and Casey don't, well, we feel that marriage should be between a man and a woman, whether, you know, it's legal or not.
So this wedding flies in the face of your values, then?
Well, yes, ma'am. Plus, I don't know, I just think that going would be disloyal to my dad. I mean, him and my mom are divorced, but
divorced for how long?
Well, over a year now, but they've been separated for like 3 years.
And how long were they married?
26, 27 years.
And they decided to end that marriage because,
well, because of her, I guess, and because of her art.
See, she was renting a room from this woman at her fancy apartment, okay? And then one thing led to another, and,
well, and what?
She decided she likes women better than men? Fancy apartments? New York deli?
Well, I think it was about living in New York, but, you know, because of the art scene there.
See, she does these crazy experimental installations, she calls them.
Okay, I got it.
Have you discussed your conflict with your father?
Well, yeah, and, you know, he's pretty cool about it. At least he says he is. He might even go to the wedding.
Really?
Wow. I'm not sure if that makes him the most forgiving man in the world or the most masochistic.
Well, the thing is, I don't even think my mom's really homosexual. I just think,
Andrew, you need to face the facts, babe. You told me your mother left your father for a lesbian hookup.
Well, that makes her a lesbian.
And now she wants to make it legal so that she and her shack-up honey can...
Well, I don't know if I'd put it that way.
Well, no, of course you wouldn't. Honor thy mother, right?
But did your mother honor the solemn covenant that she made with your father?
No. No, she didn't. It doesn't really matter what this other person's gender is.
What matters is that she forsook her vow to love, honor, and cherish her husband, to be faithful to him, right?
Well, yeah, I guess.
And then for whatever reason, your father doesn't want to man up and say, screw you, babe, if you think I'm going to your big gay wedding. I see no reason why that obligates you to... Well, my dad is a peacemaker. Plus, one of my sisters keeps bugging me.
Andrew, look, you and your girl called me for advice, so why don't you stop talking over me and listen to what I have to say?
Yeah, okay.
It doesn't matter what your father's decision is or what this silly sister of yours wants you to do. If your values are telling you that this marriage is wrong, then going to the wedding would say otherwise.
So you're saying I shouldn't go?
No, I'm saying that if you decide to go, your presence makes a statement. And if you decide not to go, that makes a different statement.
It's up to you to decide which statement you want to make. So I'll stop with the reading there. Thank you. Somebody in another city said to me, "Now, have you gotten the approval from Dr. Laura to do this scene?" And I said, "No, but I have had the that chapter vetted by the legal team at HarperCollins." And the woman who I talked to said, "She probably won't sue you." So, but that probably is what I'm nervous about. Anyway, how are we doing on time there, Erica? Well, that sounds lovely to me too. So I'm happy. It's always hard to be the first one to ask the question. But who's a brave soul out there? Anybody wondering about the story? I'll go ahead. I know you have a question. No, not me. I'll tell you about a Q&A that I did once upon a time. I was working with a kindergarten class. And I wasn't reading any of my material. But it was a hot day. It was almost at the end of the school year. And I got there early, so we were running around on the playground. And, you know, and then it was time for me to go in. I was declared the royal reader at this particular kindergarten class. So the kids all sat cross-legged on the floor, and I had a throne and a construction paper crown. And so I began my story, and the kids all had these little name tags on. And they were laughing at all the right places, and we were having a great old time. I had never felt so confident of an audience as I did that day. And so in this burst of confidence, I said, "Okay, before I turn the page, does anybody have any questions?" And this little girl, about the middle of the group, raises her hand, and I looked down at her name tag, and I said, "Yes, Fanny, what's your question?" And she said, "Why are there two big wet marks under your arms?" So, so keeping in mind that I have even answered that question, I'm happy to take any of yours. Yes, ma'am.
My question's easier than that. I've been a fan of yours since she's come undone.
Thank you.
And it impressed me when I read it. When I first read that book, I thought, this cannot be written by a man. Mm-hmm. In a way that I'd forgotten what it was like to be 13 until I read that.
Huh.
And then you do it again, and I know this much is true with the twin boys that are.
Yes, uh-huh.
How do you do that? You just read a female character like a female.
Uh-huh.
Like
yeah.
I'm
not quite sure how I get into them, and I'm also lots of times not sure why I'm doing it. But I tell you, as far as the female voices, I think part of the answer is that I grew up with older sisters and older girl cousins that were right next door to us, and the only other boy that there was to play with on McKinley Avenue growing up was Vito Signorino, and he used to throw rocks at me. Or sometimes in the wintertime, snowballs. And on one memorable day, he threw a rock inside of a snowball and hit me on the side of the head. And my mother said, "I don't want you to play with Vito anymore." And it's like, who wanted to play with Vito? I just wanted to evade him, you know? Anyway, so I was lots of times when I was a kid, I wasn't a lonely kid, but I was a solitary kid. I was usually cast in the role of the outsider. And that's not a bad thing for somebody who is going to grow up to become a fiction writer, because I was always observing their sort of wild and exotic behavior. I remember one time, I think my sisters might have been lurching toward puberty, and they were always playing games of pretend with my cousins, my next door cousins, and one day they found these net curtains up in the attic, and they wrapped themselves around them, and they were playing harem girls, and in this game they needed me to play the sultan, so they wrapped a towel around my head, and I had to sit on the floor and say things like,
peel me a grape. And and meanwhile, they're dancing and undulating around me. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, I'm like maybe 6 or 7 or something. And I'm thinking, this is so stupid. This is no fun at all. But then I got kind of interested when my sister Gail said at the end, "Don't tell Mom that we were playing this game," right? Oh, and they were calling me Kingy Boy, you know? So they were like, you know, flailing around going, "Kingy Boy, you know, where are the dancing girls and stuff?" So anyway, I kept my promise to my sister. I did not tell our mother that we were playing Kingy Boy, but I did tell Father Ziegler when I made my first confession. And I said, you know, "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It has been 0 weeks since my last confession. Here are my sins. I called my sister Gail a fat, ugly pig, and I told 2 lies, and I played Kingy Boy." And Father Ziegler says, "Well, all right, for your penance, I want you to say 3 Our Fathers and 3 Hail Marys. And wait a minute, you played what? So, you know, when you have that kind of a childhood, you know, you sort of grow up and you're able to sort of project some of this stuff. But also with She's Come Undone and the female voices. See, I work in writers' groups, and there are women in the writers' groups. And every time I hit a false note as a guy writing in a female voice, they're never shy about speaking up and telling me that that it's bogus. So I have a lot of chances to sand off the rough edges. With the twins, I had Dominic's anger. I know this much is true in my second novel. I had Dominic's anger, but I didn't have anything else, and I didn't know why he was angry. I didn't know he had a brother. And then later on, I discovered not only does he have a brother, but he has an identical twin brother who is mentally ill, who has schizophrenia. And so I obviously did research on schizophrenia because I didn't know much about it. The best research I did was talking to people who have, you know, that disease in their family. I think I've probably always had a pretty highly developed sense of empathy. And for me, I don't love to write fiction. I love to have written it. Same thing with jogging, you know. I don't like to jog. I like to have jogged. I get worried about these characters. And I'm writing as if I were they, but really I'm feeling very parental toward them. And I think, I don't know how it's going to come out until I write it. And so, you know, that's how those voices come to me. I know that sounds kind of weird, doesn't it? Basically, I'm a 62-year-old adult who's still playing with his imaginary friends. Go figure. Yes, ma'am. Was there a major influence on my life to become a writer? I would not. I would say no, and I would also say that I would never have predicted this about myself. I think what probably it comes from. I know a lot of writers who, you know, they kept journals when they were kids and they were avid readers. You know, I read stuff for school. I wrote stuff for school, but it wasn't my impulse. But what my impulse was that I drew all the time. I loved to draw, and I would make up my own comic books and that kind of stuff. So I guess that was a kind of writing, you know, because I'd do the cartoon bubbles and make up stories, and then I'd, you know, get them all colored, and then I'd give them to my mother, and she would sew up the left-hand side on her sewing machine. So, you know, she was, I guess, was my first publisher. But I think that sort of gave me a leg up when I went to college. I thought I was going to be an art major, and then I took a couple of classes, literature classes, and I remember reading The Great Gatsby, and thinking, "Wow, this is so cool that a lot of the writing is between the lines, and you know, a lot of what is not said but implied." And I'm thinking, "Wow!" And then of course I had read The Catcher in the Rye, and I'm thinking, "Oh my God, a character in a book talks like a real person. And so, the, you know, those, I guess those were some of the big influences in my life. To Kill a Mockingbird, love that story. And when I was a high school teacher, I would teach that book every year. And when you prepare a book that you already know year after year, you begin to see things like the architecture of the story and how, you know, how she built that story, not just the what the story is and who the characters were. So I guess those are some of the things that sort of led me to this. Maybe one or two more questions. I know we only have about 10 minutes. So.
I want to thank you for the work that you do with Mennonite Correctional Facility.
Thank you. Thank you.
But when you talk about these people come to you, so are you excited when you get up and you start to write to see what's coming, or do you dread it? Do you have certain times of the day that you're like, okay, I'm going to write now, or do you just, does it just come to you?
I do. I'm fairly disciplined about it, and I am a morning person. So my most days I'll get up, and my friend Ethel will show up in the driveway. She and I go to the gym together, and I probably wouldn't go to the gym about half as many times if she wasn't in the driveway waiting for me. But I like to get physical exercise in the morning and then get right to the writing. And my creative brain just sort of naturally shuts off at about 2 o'clock or on bad days, 1 o'clock, and then I go upstairs and watch Days of Our Lives and have a sandwich. But that would be my schedule. I wanted to talk briefly about, and only briefly, Erica, about you mentioned my work with the women at the correctional facility. Back in 1999, there were a couple of suicides at that prison. And there were several more attempts, and a woman that I used to play with, who was then the librarian at the prison school, called me up, and she said, "We're reaching out to everybody that we know to come in, and you know, just we're trying to distract the women. And could you come in and talk about your writing?" And I had just done the two Oprah shows. You know, she picked two of my books, and so I said I was reluctant. I said I would, and I didn't want to do it, and 40 women had signed up for the program. And so I went there, and I talked about my writing for about 90 minutes, and then at the end I said, does anybody have any questions about my writing? And these were the questions about my writing. You met Oprah? You know? They were sort of all along those lines. You know, Oprah's cool, you know what I'm saying? Is that a question? You know, it kind of is. So so anyway, the scariest woman in the room, who had been sort of eyeing me suspiciously the whole 90 minutes, she was the one who said at the end, she raised her hand, she said, "Thanks for coming." And I said, "Oh, you're welcome." And she said, "Are you coming back?" And I think it's just because I am such a chicken that I said yes. Anyway, that was 14 years ago. I'm still going down there because the women, I've given them what I know about how writing works, and they've taught me, you know, as much or more about their lives and lives that are unlike mine. You know, thank God, I was never incested when I was a kid, as the majority of them were. The Hour I First Believed, which starts, you know, with the Columbine tragedy, my third novel, and it becomes a reflection on how detrimental post-traumatic stress can be. I learned about post-traumatic stress and living with that from my work with the women and from, you know, reacting to their writing. With this novel, this one gets into the area of child sexual abuse, and they gave me that education as well. So it's been a life-changing thing for me. And you know, writing is a lonely life in a lot of ways. So it's really a lot of fun to come and, you know, meet folks like you. Just the right people showed up tonight. How cool is that? But also, I really, really enjoy my
my work with the women, because, you know, you give a little, you get back so much. You all know that. Okay, so I'm going to end there, or Erica's going to get mad at me. So,
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.